Welcome to Wines We Drink, a podcast for wine lovers and learners. I'm Charlotte Norsworthy Varnum, and together with my counterpart Keith Herndon, we'll be exploring a new wine each week. Keith is a lover of wine, and I am a learner of wine, and we hope that you'll continue learning and sipping along with us. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Wines We Drink, a podcast for all you wine lovers and learners out there. Today is our fifth episode of the third season, and we are so excited for our show today. I'm Charlotte Norsworthy Varnum, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Keith Herndon, a certified wine sommelier.
Charlotte, hello again, and welcome back to my wine kitchen turned podcast studio. A big shout out to our listeners. We may not say this enough, but thank you for your support out there. We couldn't do this show without our loyal followers.
I totally agree. You know, it's hard to believe we're already approaching the midway point of our third season. We've had such a wonderful experience sharing so many great wines with you. And if you've missed any of this season's episodes, you can find them along with all of seasons one and two on most any podcast platform, including Apple, Google, and Spotify.
Yes, we've had fun so far drinking some great wines on this show. And I have another one for today. Right. We've started this season off with some great summer sippers, and today is no exception. We're staying with that summer wine theme.
Hey, that sounds like a plan to me.
I want to start by sharing one of my buying observations, you know, okay. One of my wine buying observations. I've picked this up over the years, and I think it's something that our listeners can take to heart.
Well, by all means, please share.
So some of the best wineries often have an offering in their portfolio that I'll call a project wine, for a lack of a better term, right? The winery may be known for a particular varietal or style. You know, maybe their really prominent grape that they produce is a Cabernet Sauvignon, for example, or a Chardonnay, right? But they'll often have other wines that they've created to complete their portfolios. Sometimes it's to allow their winemaker to experiment. Other times, it's to make use of surplus grapes. Whatever the reason, discerning consumers can often find an exceptional quality wine at a great value when looking at a great winery's entire portfolio, not only for what it's famous for producing. If it's a great winemaker and a great winery, they're not going to cut corners on something that's even down in their portfolio. Mm-hmm. So, you know, find those really good values from the really great winemakers when they're doing something that's not their normal, you know, famous wine.
Right. Sort of a think outside of the box scenario. I think it's a great shopping tip, too. I'm sure that that's kind of leading us along to today's selection, right?
Yes. When my wife and I were visiting Napa Valley last year, we were fortunate to land a couple of tasting spots in the venerable Trefethen family vineyards. I mean, it was a gorgeous day in Napa. Tasting in the winery's courtyard was outstanding. I mean, we had enjoyed their luscious Cabernet Sauvignon and an exquisite Chardonnay. And I'll also plug one of their wonderful red blends that Trefethen marks. They marketed under the name Dragon's Tooth.
Oh, wow.
Right? But it was a little marketed white blend that caught my attention. It wasn't even on the list of wines that we would be tasting that day, but our wine host offered us a pour, and she called it the winery's porch pounder, right? And I was like, oh yeah, that's great. And then she said, you know, this is what I and most of our staff take home with us. You know, okay. We drink it all summer. And so my wife and I gladly accepted her offer of the pour, and I have to say, it's now one of our go-to summer wines.
Right? The inside scoop. I mean, what a serendipitous discovery. So what is it called?
Well, it's called Quandary, and even the cork has a question mark on it, okay? I'm not even sure they know why they named it that. I couldn't find it on their website. The wine educator didn't know when I was talking to her at the winery, but I found it to be a perfect summer white. I mean, as our tasting host said, it's a porch pounder.
I mean, hey, it sounds great, right? So let's get started. Could you pour us some of this porch pounder? I love that. I'm going to keep that in my vocab.
Well, we're opening the 2021 vintage, and this is a blend of 56% Chardonnay, 34% Riesling, and 10% Sauvignon Blanc. Okay, I'm beginning to pour this glass for you here.
I love that sound. I hope everyone else does too.
Yeah, it's always great hearing the glass of wine being filled, right?
As you were just pouring it, the color on it looks so fresh, crisp. It's very, very clear in the glass. You can see slam through it. And this may be because there's the label itself is green, but it seems like in the glass too, there's sort of a green twinge to it.
Yeah, maybe just a little bit of a green tint there, you know. It's only Sauvignon Blanc by 10%, you know.
Oh, wow.
Only 10%
okay.
of Sauvignon Blanc in the blend. But the color is very similar to that pure Sauvignon Blanc that we drank last week.
Right.
You know, so now put your nose in there and let me know what aromas come to mind.
Mm. Wow. That first smell is, it's super floral and it's fresh floral, right? It feels like a fresh bouquet of flowers. That's me trying my hand at writing wine descriptions. But also, you know, there's a distinct, albeit muted, lemon smell to it. You know, I would say I'm more confident on my feelings on the florals. I don't think my nose is really discerning enough at this point to get much more specific than that.
Well, yes, there is definitely a lemony smell to this. There's an overall sensation of citrus, don't you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. But I would say that even with that, the floral smells are really the dominant first thing that hits your nose.
Well, you're going to be really happy when I turn to the winemaker's notes here, because you'll see those floral notes that the winemaker described as jasmine and verbena, mm-hmm. right? If you're not familiar with verbena, that's a flowering plant that gives off a lemony scent.
Okay.
So it's floral and lemony all together, right?
You know?
So I think you were spot on with those floral and lemon aromas. You know, a brief aside on the chemistry in wine, the reaction between acid and alcohol releases compounds called esters, which can lead to fruity and floral aromas that we sense in the wine. So another class of compounds in wines are called terpenes. And they create a variety of aromas. Certain types of these terpenes create the citrusy aromas that we get. So, you know, with this, you can see how these compounds are reacting in this wine, right? So, okay, enough of the chemistry. Let's taste this wine.
Enough of the science experiment, right?
Right,
here we go. Ooh, wow. I mean, I would say from the aromas, I was expecting one thing, but the taste is a different one thing. So before I try to start describing it, I'm going to try one more sip.
I think I know where you're going to go with this.
Okay.
You know, those lemony and floral scents kind of set you up for a strong citrus flavor, but it's more subtle once you get it in your mouth,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a much more subtle thing.
It is, absolutely. I mean, on the front end, I'm getting apple and pear, and I would say even with those citrus scents, it's such a smooth sip.
Mm-hmm. You know, it definitely has a strong opening on the palate, you know, of tree fruits. You know, I'd even add in some peach in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You just get a lot of layering of flavors from this blend. So let's have another taste.
Okay. Yeah. As I keep tasting, I would agree with you on the peach item. But, you know, another layer I'm getting is maybe some pineapple. It's really not until the very end, not until the finish, that you get that lemon citrus. But somewhere in the middle there is maybe some pineapple.
Right. Yeah. It's really interesting. You know, I think a good way to describe this wine is through its layers.
Yeah.
Right? It's almost like a layer cake, you know. It opens with the tree fruits that we talked about, and then those give away to some tropical fruits, and then it finishes with that bright acidity associated with the citrus, with that lemon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, isn't this a wonderfully complex blend, you know? To be called a porch pounder is almost a disservice to this wine.
Well, I would say I could dream now about being on a porch. It's such an easy sip. It's not something that you really have to think too hard on when you're drinking it because it's so enjoyable. But that being said, it's not simple, you know. And I think that if you're worried about that you're still getting a lot of nuance in here. You know, you mentioned the official tasting notes a few moments ago, and so I had to sneak a peek. They mentioned in this specifically a slightly sweet finish, and the acidity on the finish is really what I noticed the most. But as I keep sipping it, I did pick up on that slightly sweet note right there at the end. And for me, I think that that's where that Porch Pounder feeling comes in. It's really like that summer lemonade, right, effect that it gives you.
Oh, wow. That lemonade effect, that's really what this wine is, isn't it? Right? It's a lemonade.
Right.
I mean, it really is nice. I like that. You know, I like that. So I think that, you know, that's really a great observation. You know, this wine is only 12% alcohol by volume. So there is likely a hint of a little residual sugar there that maybe contributes to that note at the end. You know, I don't want to mislead our listeners, though, however, you know, this would not be considered a sweet wine at all.
Yeah.
If you look at the dry to sweet bar on the Vivino app, the indicator for this wine is decidedly to the left of center, you know, indicating much more dry than sweet.
Absolutely. Right? But I think that if you are someone who thinks that you really only enjoy a sweet wine, so this would almost be a great pathway wine for you to kind of foray maybe into some more of those drier whites. And, you know, I would say, too, that this wine is really elegant. It's elegantly drinkable, maybe, right? And so it still has a lot of posture despite it being a sipper. And like last week's selection, it really belongs on your list for those summer parties. It would impress your friends. How much would our audience expect to pay for today's Trefethen's Porch Pounder?
This wine is priced very similar to last week's Sauvignon Blanc. At the time of our recording, the Vivino app was listing this 2021 Quandary at a national average price of $30, which was also the price listed on the Trefethen website where you can order it directly, right? I'll repeat myself from last week. This is a very good price when you consider the Vivino app also ranks this vintage as among the top 2% wines of the world.
Wow. See? Okay. Well, then there you have it, listeners. Another top 2% wine featured on the fabulous wines we drink. You know, your great selections, Keith, they really just keep on coming, and I get to enjoy them selfishly. And you can too, for those of you listening. So remember, though, as we are talking about these wines that we're drinking on this podcast, we don't get any promotional consideration from the wines that we talk about on the show. Keith is doing all the work. He's selecting these wines because he likes them, he drinks them, and we're not paid influencers.
Right. You know, it's always good to remind our audience that we're independent. You may not like the same wines that I do, but I can assure you that we only talk about the wines that I drink on Wines We Drink.
Right. Well, hey, is there anything else you'd like to add about today's selection before we talk about my favorite part, which is the food pairing?
Yes, I would like to add that while this wine is not considered maybe the star of the Trefethen portfolio, They've been making this white blend label for years, over a decade that I could find. And this year's vintage is 100% grapes from the winery's estate vineyard known as the Main Ranch. Mm. It truly reflects the family's commitment, you know, to high-end winemaking up and down its portfolio.
Absolutely. And I mean, if this is not considered the star, then man, there's more to explore, I would say, from the Trefethen family. And I think it's a great point to underscore. I'm still looking forward to serving it at a party or two this summer. So, okay, jumping to the pairing now, what would you suggest that we pair this with?
This is a great wine to pair with a leafy salad and all sorts of seafood. It works nicely with shellfish, especially in our part of the world, some of that shrimp up from the Atlantic coast. And for a cheese selection, you can find a soft goat cheese. But now I have a special pairing treat in store for you.
Okay, so wait, we're not doing cheese for the pairing today?
No, we're changing it up. Okay. Trefethen has an excellent chef on staff, Chris Kennedy, and he's posted on the winery's website a relatively simple recipe for a totally vegan dish. He calls it a Meyer Lemon Couscous Tabbouleh. I'm going to say, I am in no way capable of creating this to the standards of Chef Kennedy, but I gave it the old college try, okay? So I've put some of this tabbouleh salad on your plate. So I want you to take a bite of the tabbouleh and then follow it by a sip of the wine and let me know what you think.
Okay, a treat.
Yeah, I'm going to do the same thing while you're doing it.
Oh, wow. That totally works. The lemon flavors of this dish and the acidity in the wine, it's the perfect complement. So, hey, Chef Kennedy, if you're listening, great pairing, and I think Keith here did you proud.
Well, I'm glad you like it. You know, go in there for another bite and another taste. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to, you know, to try this a couple of times, you know, to get that really nice mix of flavors and wine. You know, I'm glad you gave me the shout out, but I really think it's this great wine that's covering up for my errors in the tabbouleh. You know, a good wine can cover up a lot of my cooking mistakes, okay?
Well, hey, that's a great tip in general, I would say, right? If you have a good enough wine, the food will pass. But I will say this is a great recipe, and I'm going to honestly finish everything that's on my plate right here in front of me. So I'm going to continue biting and sipping. We're going to take our short break. We'll be back soon with the show segment that we like to call The Finish. And Keith has a history lesson to share, I hear.
Yes, it's really interesting.
Hello, everyone. We're back from the break. The portion of the show we're at now is called The Finish. And so, Keith, before the break, I told our listeners that you're going to be sharing a history lesson with us today. So what's that all about?
Yeah, you know, earlier in the episode, I described Trefethen Family Vineyards as venerable, right? Mm-hmm. The dictionary defines that as calling forth respect through age and attainments. So that is a great description of Trefethen given its historical significance to the California wine industry.
Yeah, that's a million-dollar vocab word right there. and I understand that the wine we drink today is not from some run-of-the-mill winery. I'm eager to hear this backstory.
Well, for context, I need to start by taking our listeners all the way back to 1976 and what is remembered as the Judgment of Paris. Stephen Spurrier, who was then a young Brit immersing himself in the wine industry in Paris, traveled to Napa Valley to see for himself if what he was hearing about the wines there was true. He loved his trip, and he took some of the wines back and organized the tasting. Of course, the California wines came out on top in what history now records as the Judgment of Paris. Right? But honestly, that wasn't as much of a defining moment as what happened a few years later. There were a lot of critics that derided the tasting of 1976, and there were those that questioned the methodology, but it certainly served to put a spotlight on California wines, but I don't think it was the spotlight, right? Okay?
Well, and yeah, a spotlight, sure, indeed, and I'm sure the French weren't happy with the publicity that sprang from that, took away from it.
Yeah. So you're right about that. You know, so in 1979, a French publication called Galton Milieu's Le Nouveau Guide, that's a mouthful, you know, set up one of the largest wine competitions that had been held at that time. They invited wines from 33 different countries, and it became an event that is now referred to in history as the Wine Olympics.
Okay. And so let me guess, a California wine won again?
Yes, but not just any wine. Trefethen's 1976 vintage Chardonnay was declared best Chardonnay in the world. A Chardonnay, after all. You know, one could argue that Chardonnay is the signature varietal of France. So it was a difficult pill for the French to swallow. They couldn't understand how an upstart wine territory in the United States could best them. You know, many of the French winemakers simply refused to accept the verdict. So they challenged the winner to yet another face-off.
Wow.
Right? So 6 months later, in a tasting organized in the heart of Burgundy by the famous Drouin wine family, there was a rematch. The results were the same. Okay? Trefethen's Chardonnay came out on top again in another blind tasting. So at that time, a quote attributed to Robert Drouin, it seemed to put the whole issue to rest. He reportedly said that Trefethen Chardonnay was, quote, the yardstick by which all other Chardonnays must be measured, end quote.
Wow, wow, okay. That's such a good story. I mean, I think we take for granted the quality of California wines, and there's a lot of pioneers who made that happen.
Absolutely. You know, and I would encourage any of our listeners who visit the Napa Valley to take some time to learn about the rich history of the wine pioneers, especially those families like the Trefethens in the 1970s who believed in their products enough to put them on the world stage and let them be judged for what they were. They knew they had excellent wines, but it took beating the French for the world to understand what was coming out of California in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. And it really did set the stage for how we consider California to be as it relates to a global hub for some of the top wines in the world.
Absolutely.
Another excellent finish then. That was a really interesting history lesson. Thank you for today's episode. It doesn't have to be boring to learn about history. So what do you have in store for us next week?
Okay, well, I'm not going to give away the finish for next week's show yet, okay? But we'll be in our sixth installment of what we call our summer case of episodes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're halfway. So like in the previous two seasons, we're going to celebrate the midpoint with some delicious sparkling wine. You'll have to join us next week for the details.
I always enjoy the bubbly. So I'll be here next week, and I hope everyone here will be listening and joining us. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Wines We Drink. Listen to our other episodes anywhere you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on Twitter @WinesWeDrink and on Instagram @TheWinesWeDrink. Cheers.